Is that the buildup?
That's the buildup, yeah. Yeah. And I wanted to say in a way that probably the whole talk could just be boiled down to that old question, what is Zen? And the answer, it's like falling off a log. So, good evening, Bodhisattvas. How are your delusions doing? Mine are alive and well, thank you. It would be nice to sort everything into two neat piles. Delusions over here and truths over there. Opinions over here, facts over there. Or false opinions versus true opinions. Or wrong names versus right names. Think fallen language versus the Adamic language we're told was spoken in Eden. Or true predicates and judgments versus false ones. Or those Plato's true philosophers versus those devious sophists. The American philosopher William James will make a guest appearance tomorrow night to help us consider all that pragmatically and to help us think about some useful criteria that might end up transforming our sense of those distinctions without quite tossing them overboard. A lot of Buddhism, including Zen, tends to take a more sweeping view, at least as a starting point. Why not take all your beliefs and judgments, all your models and names and opinions, and supposed statements of fact, and put them, at least for a while, in just one big pile? The two-pile drill, though, it's pretty much hardwired in, language is binary, yes or no, is that right or wrong, tends, for all the benefits it provides, to cause some serious problems. So it'd be great to have one pile. It would be great if we could get to one pile just by tossing the bad pile overboard, leaving us with perfected and purified objects of knowledge. But that's really just more of the two-pile drill, no? Zen tends to take a dim view of that approach, a kind of subject-object world on steroids, super-knower and super-known, so you're finally the perfected knowing subject who damn well knows the actual blinking object and keeps it with such perfect knowledge perfectly in place. I think that's kind of a view of practice, or at least a view of practice that some of us at least start with. That would be like doing a jiu-jitsu flip on Kant. Noumena ahoy, so long, all merely crummy, human-distorted perceived phenomena. At the end of Hemingway's The Sun Also Rises, the main character, Jake, says regretfully, "We could have had such a damn good time." To which his always not quite paramour, Brett Ashley, replies, with rueful humor, "Isn't it lovely to think so?" So we're not going to. Okay, if not that, then what? All this admittedly sounds pretty abstract in a way, a problem in epistemology, the branch of philosophy that worries over the status of our knowledge. But the question of how to work with opinion and judgment has more than a casual relation to Buddhism's preoccupation with the self, which may or may not exist, or may not exist. With apologies, here's a quick day job sidebar. The Romanian linguist, literary critic, and psychoanalyst Julia Kristeva writes about a stage of early childhood language development called the phetic phase. Think of thesis and argument, or here, the beginnings of the ability to make a rudimentary one. "That snake is dangerous," say. That's a step up from mere designation, just saying snake, because it adds a predication or judgment. And it turns out that acquiring that ability is the crucial step in generating a human self, an I, a knower who stands over against a known thing and knows in their judgment how to position themselves over against it with a stance or attitude. What comes next is indeed the ability to use correctly the shifter pronoun I, which turns out to be trickier than you might think. Anyway, they go together like a horse and carriage, judgments and a self. So is that clear? What I'm drawing on is that, you know, sort of theories of language and personhood development that say actually that what the human self that we know ourselves to be really originates as a function of language and the ability to make judgments, that I set over against things really wasn't there until we acquired that ability. And actually then the shifters that you are the last things to acquire, so you know how to say I, you become that kind of abstract human subject you know, who can do those things. And that's really what we mean by a self. I'll tell you a quick sidebar. When my daughter was two and she was trying to learn that stuff, I was holding her up by the bookshelf and she kept pointing and saying, "You want it, you want it." So it takes a while before you know, can do that. In our neck of the Zen woods, anyway, students of Joan, we tend not to try to eradicate the self or stamp out its functions or stamp our little feet about them, so much as to watch our sense of self come and go, get diffuse and reform. In no, there's only going and coming. Maybe working with judgments and opinions with a similar attitude, watching them come and go, is one good way to work on, or is it with, the self? Back to a couple columns from last night, and these are the ones on the sheet. Here's the first one. Haven't you heard? Wu Xie went to see Shitou. He had made an agreement with himself beforehand, saying, "If there's a court at the first word, I'll stay. Otherwise, I'll go." Shitou just sat on his seat. Xie shook at his sleeves and went out. Shitou knew that Wu Xie was a vessel of truth, so he had extended his teaching to him. But Xie hadn't understood his meaning. He had announced his departure and gone out. When he got to the gate, Shitou called out to him, "Reverend!" When Xie looked back, Shitou said, "From birth to death, it's only this. Don't seek any more for anything else by turning your head and revolving your brain." At these words, Xie was greatly enlightened. It's only this. In a way, this sounds like the 3 pounds of flax cone. You know, what is Buddha, 3 pounds of flax? Or if you can't picture flax, 3 pounds of rice. It ain't somewhere else, Jack. It's right here under your nose. Just look. Or also, it's as clear as the nose on your face. I'm saying that's one way to understand that. It's only this. But I think there's more. Maybe it's because Wu Xie has stalked off and Shitou calls to him across a distance. Linguists call this a deictic, a pointing word. You know, what's this? What happens here is a little stranger than pointing your finger at the bag of rice. Shitou probably doesn't even literally point. So it's a conundrum. This is what's right here, the rice and your nose, but it's also the surround, the background. And in a Zen context, that background can feel very big indeed, yet it's also somehow inside the foreground or no different from it. So maybe Shitou is pointing at something you can't point to, something that isn't a thing. What is this might fill you with awe or wonder then, make you shiver at the ineffable. What you can't conjure up is something you could possibly objectify and know. Meanwhile, particulars are always rising and falling. What is this? Here's the rest of that other koan. In no, there's no going and coming. In no, there's only going and coming. The hypothetical seeker in our second koan from last night seems to consider delusions or karmic consciousness what we think because of how all those causes and conditions have made us the particular gnarly, twisty selves we are, as insurmountable obstacles that might preclude such an experience, blocking us from it. Guishan asked Yangshan, "Suppose someone asks you out of the blue, sentient beings have only endless karmic consciousness with no foundation to rely on. How would you work with this?" Yangshan says he'd pull a Shitou and Wu Xie on him anyway. If a student like that came, I'd call, "Hey, so-and-so." When the student turns his head, I'd say, "What is it?" I imagine the hypothetical student having a Wu Xie moment here as it is pointed to and not pointed to. Then Yangshan says something I find really startling. Then I'd wait while he thinks about it. Then I'd say, not only is karmic consciousness endless, but there's no foundation to rely on. Yangshan first takes a beat, allows a moment for the ineffable to manifest itself. And right into that space, that moment of awed disorientation, and perhaps surprise and surprising reorientation, he drops karmic consciousness and calls it endless. Something shifts here, turns around. Dropped into this space, your delusions, opinions, and judgments are just more things in the foreground, rising and falling out of and back into that unspecifiable but palpable big this. They don't need to be any more of a problem or impediment than a tree or your friend. A cat, a cloud, a delusion, the sky. It doesn't matter. Your views don't need to be permanently eradicated or corrected and perfected into true judgments that would yield you an undistorted conceptual map of the things you think of as objects. I think we mostly regard our judgments as if they were good, expensive binoculars that magnify and clarify the object world, keeping things in proper focus and yielding us the truth. If we're grouchy or having a bad day, or if we're Zen students and have got the incurable itch, maybe we start to complain about our judgments as cut-rate, distorting binoculars we ought to be able to replace with more expensive ones. But in this moment, something turns around, and we see them in their own right. We see through them in a different sense. Instead of seeing the world through them, or thinking we do, we just see them or see through them, like, I see right through you, you scoundrel, as empty, or as emptiness assuming another temporary form. This is a bigger deal than it might seem. What's more intimate for each of us than our feelings and judgments and thoughts? What more local and intimate experience of emptiness than to see them this way? Here's a story I sometimes tell on myself as an example. At a weekend retreat here in Tucson a long time ago with John Tarrant, I sat with my hands in prayer position for morning greeting, waiting for John to pass my cushion and look into my face, and presumably my soul. I guess it's worth noting that someone who knows me pretty well had been telling me I'm defensive, though nothing could be further from the truth. She was just attacking me. As John passed, I felt a kind of inward wince. He could tell I was doing it wrong. My heart mind wasn't right. I don't think I'm the only one who can find John a little bit scary. But right then it came over me that I had no idea at all what John was actually thinking. Duh. Instead of seeing John through my view of him, I was suddenly seeing through that view instead, as empty, dreamlike, insubstantial, rising and falling, going poof. I still find a couple things surprising about what happened next. First, such a small thing had disproportionate effects. It felt like everything fell open, starting with me, and things went on feeling that way for hours. The main thing, I think, was just the view going poof, going empty. Everything, including myself, felt lighter, brighter, more free. And it wasn't that a better, more correct view of what John was up to popped into my head to replace the poofed view. I didn't have a view of what he'd been thinking, and I didn't want one. I wanted to enjoy the lightness of not having that particular view right now, of not having any view at all, though I didn't stop and bother to explain it that way to myself at the time. It's true that in the disorientation of what was happening, the things around me seemed more vibrant, somehow more there and more dreamlike at once. But I didn't feel like I knew them better exactly. It felt more like they knew me. It was as if when the view that kept things stable went poof, I tumbled into the field instead of standing over against it as a knower knowing the known. If things were somehow more available to me, that felt like a function of my being more available to them. You might say that as the judgment fell away, the self of the thetic phase lost much of its separate solidity. I am I because I stand by my judgments. One more thing, which I'll import from some other related experiences reported by other people as well as my own. If sometimes one particular thing looms up out of the interpermeating field with particular intensity and sharpness in such moments, with what's sometimes called suchness or tathagata quality, it's oddly different from a knowable object set over against you. It's not like the subject-object relation perfected on steroids. Me over here behind the world's best binoculars, really once and for all knowing the friggin' object. If, say, a crow caws, and that caw looms right up, it isn't exactly over against you. When it calls you. it fetches you. It's itself, it's everything, suddenly concretized and local. And it's also dramatically you. You're fetched, and you answer the caw. You caw. It calls you into the field, and it calls you or recalls you to yourself, except self is the wrong word here, but all the alternatives I can think of feel clunky. If this whole description seems a little clunky too, that's doubtless in part a function of my clumsiness. But it's also true that the tradition says you have to know such moments for yourself, that conceptual language can point at them, but not quite render them. Of course, they are moments where the familiar knowing self set over against the known object relationship that's built into our language no longer quite obtains. So the tradition slips into oxymorons about a perfected knowledge that isn't knowledge, but a shifted feeling for or sense of things. Or it talks about prajna, or Suzuki talks about something you can't experience, but nevertheless do sort of experience, or that you don't experience, but realize. Maybe not mostly in the sense of becoming aware of it, but also of fulfilling it in your own person, though person also isn't quite the right word. And if you can't claim this as exactly an experience, maybe that's because it's less about laying claim or staking a claim to reality than being claimed by it. In such moments, the world lays claim to you without recourse, which can feel a little scary, but also surprisingly serene. As John says, you can rely on the fact that there's nothing to rely on. And he says, you really can rely on it, a groundless ground. Strangely, karmic consciousness isn't an impediment to moments like this, but a gate. So luckily, delusions will recur, being endless, giving us lots of occasions for our known world to crack open, that's great. Giving us lots of occasions for our known world to crack open and for us to fall in. Wonderful. All right. That's the joke for them. Sorry, but we're not done yet. I think it might be helpful to take a few minutes mapping some of what I've been adducing onto a central Zen text, the Lankavatara Sutra, a difficult and complexly dialectical work about which I'm by no means an expert. I'll be relying on Red Pine's translation and commentary, as well as on talks by Joan and Norman Fisher, with the usual all errors are my own disclaimer. Supposedly, when the first Chan patriarch Bodhidharma, who brought intensive meditation-centered Buddhism to China, got up from his mythical 9 years facing a wall in his cave to pass the robe and bowl along to Weka, he gave him the Lanka with a "this is all you'll need" seal of approval. So it's a central Zen text. I need to note at the beginning that the Lanka is a paradox of the Cretan liar variety. A guy from Crete says all Cretans are liars. You know that one, right? No? Oh, so there's a Cretan who walks up, a guy from Crete walks up to you and says, all Cretans are liars, right? So if he's telling the truth, then all Cretans aren't liars, and if he's, you know, okay. So I need to note at the beginning that the Lanka is a paradox of the Cretan liar variety. A guy from Crete says, all Cretans are liars. It's telling you in complexly propositional language about the radical distortions inseparable from propositional language. So in some ways, the Lanka positions itself as a useful fiction, hoping to get at something beyond its words, ineffable. And it's very explicit about that. Starting, I think, from an appreciation of the fact that human selves are fundamentally structured by language, the subject-object relation language establishes, and the judgments and propositions speaking selves propound, the Lanka takes a sweeping view and says that every view or model or judgment we put forth is projection only, a picture of things inevitably, fundamentally distorted by the very fact that it's propounded by a judging eye over here, making a claim about a world out there set over against itself. The sweeping only in projection only insists that there's no knowledge that escapes this trap, though there may be a wisdom that's aware of it and senses the world another way. So not knowing is most intimate. So it's a startling claim, one that suggests we can't ever escape delusion in any final sense. So you might as well leave now. You know. Laying out its elaborate conceptual categories, even though it says all conceptual categories are distortions, the Lanka calls the world as we ordinarily see it imagined reality and claims that it's a distortion of something it calls dependent reality. Dependent reality, it turns out, means interdependent, no separate things, but instead interpermeation. Imagined reality, which sees fixed, separate entities, is a distortion of this interdependent reality, a distortion caused largely by language and its operation of designation, which, of course, generates the delusion of a world made of seemingly stabilized entities, each with its own stable name yanked from the flux. But, hold on, in the Lanka, both these views are models, since they are views or models, are projection only. So that's pretty interesting. Dependent reality, which is interpermeation and interdependence. So that's, you know, okay, that's another projection, another delusion in some way. The notion I relied on earlier of turning around or turning the mind around also comes from the Lanka. Keeping the explanation as simple as I can and hoping not to get too much wrong by doing so, the Lanka propounds a model in which there are 8 consciousnesses, 5 for the 5 senses, a 6th, which I think is language specific, that builds conceptual structures and posits separate things from those sense data, and a 7th, which mistakenly attributes those conceptual structures to a stable self that would be their source, when in fact the concepts generate the sense of self. Then there's the 8th, which is crucial, tricky, and mysterious. It's called the storehouse consciousness, or Alaya Vijnana, and as Joan explains it, it's a repository for each one of us of all our experiences, or perhaps more accurately, of not only our conscious experiences, but also our unconscious impulses and our raw sense data. It's a little bit like Freud's notion of the pre-conscious, residues of all those sense data that bombard us all day and never make it into consciousness. But it's more inclusive. It's also full of precipitates of our feelings and reactions and desires and aversions and distortions, and as such, it's the source, if those traces are repeated and strong enough, of future desire, distortion, impulse, action, and karma. Importantly, it's a multiple, unfocused, non-narrative collection. It doesn't tell a story with the self at the center, though it can lead to actions which a self can then claim and construe. But the Lanka says we can turn this around, turn it back on itself. Instead of the common process in which those traces tend to aggregate themselves into impulses, views, judgments, stories, actions, and more karma, we can see through them. Not see the world through them, but see them themselves, and then, as we said before, experience them as rising and falling, empty. And the more we do this in meditation and elsewhere, the more something else that isn't a thing becomes palpable. What is it? Norman talks about this as awareness becoming aware of awareness. Then he says, if that's too abstract to practice with, you can sit with a sense of presence or an awareness of silence. One interesting thing about this, I think, is that your sense of presence will be neither the same as nor separate from your awareness of particular presences, just as your sense of silence might be neither the same as nor separate from your awareness of sound. Particular presences and particular sounds rising and falling in a very big field, or as the field. I'm not going to fill this in, but I'll just note it. In our tradition, when we work with no, I think it's a similar practice. A student asked Zhaozhu, does a dog have Buddha nature? Zhaozhu replied, no. What is this no? If you think of the things you're gently saying no to, that really is in a way like turning the mind around. Quick sidebar for students of Joan, and I just thought of this a couple days ago, and probably all you guys know this, but I was quite startled. So quick sidebar for students of Joan. She used to invite us, if a compelling problem or obsession grabbed hold of us and didn't seem to want to set us free, to bring it into our meditation and lean into it, experiencing it as part of the big field of meditative awareness, in defiance of traditional instructions to steer clear of that kind of stuff. I'm thinking now that was her particular way of inviting us into the practice the Lanka recommends. a gradual purification of the storehouse consciousness, slowly transforming its memory traces into a local and intimate version of things rising and falling in a spacious, quiet field. A transformation of Alaya Vijnana into what the Lanka calls the Tathagata Garbha, the womb of the Buddhas. Here's an odd thing, maybe. When we come out of meditation and lift our eyes to the world, it seems to have some of the same qualities as meditative awareness. That's probably, at least in part, projection, though to the extent we're claimed by something ineffable, maybe not entirely. But if, say, a mostly empty sky with clouds floating through it feels eerily similar to a consciousness in which thoughts appear and dissipate, a version of what Suzuki calls big mind, the translator David Hinton wonders if that's maybe because our very conceptions of our minds, as well as how we think and feel about them, took shape as a kind of metaphorical extrapolation of our awareness of the sky. It's not so much that the sky is like our minds then, but more that our sense of what our minds are derives from our experience of the sky. So if Suzuki's big mind sometimes strikes us as kind of a metaphor, the universe doesn't really have a mind, does it? At least if we're feeling skeptical. It might also go the other way around. Our sense of a mind isn't exactly or only our sense of a mind. Maybe that's another way in which we tumble into the world. Almost done. It turns out that the Lanka's rigorous deconstructions have a similarly expansive and liberating purpose. If the Lanka suggests that all our models, all our judgments and opinions about reality are projections only, that isn't to keep the world at bay. It's to slide us out of our inveterate stance as knowers so that we can sense, instead or as well, the way the world claims us, ready or not, knowing or not. Since there is nothing to attain, the Bodhisattva lives by Prajnaparamita, with no hindrance in the mind, no hindrance and therefore no fear, far beyond delusive thinking. Except, as we discussed in our Heart Sutra study group, far beyond turns out to mean right in the midst of. The Lanka insists on this point. According to the Lanka, if we turn the mind around and see through our projections, what happens next? Well, as we wander around the world then, more projections. Spewing categories itself, the Lanka supplements imagined reality and dependent reality with perfected reality. But perfected reality turns out, who would have thunk it, to be not the absence of projections, but just experiencing our projections as projections. As Wallace Stevens said, the necessity to believe in a fiction that we know to be a fiction. You might say, pardon the solecism, it's when we don't project our projections. Or the Lanka says, the wise are neither confused nor not confused by delusion. Not confused because they see through their delusions, see them for what they are. Confused because they continue to see through them, seeing the world in the ways the delusions project. The way Norman talks about that, then, it's up letting us off the hook, and it's kind of relaxing. Like, you'll never get it right, so. That sounds kind of like the world of Shinto, where folks who have a deep sense of emptiness and interpermeation wander through a world also shaped by causes and conditions, full of billiard balls, hard knocks, and boxes for which we can't always find lids, and where, perhaps, we're neither confused nor not confused by our models, opinions, and views. Stay tuned. Thank you. So we have a little time for comments, discussion, questions. I like doing that. I know it's a lot to listen to.
Kind of interested in your opinion about Suzuki's big money.
What I was trying to say was that it's always really beautiful and it makes sense. And I kind of wonder, I don't know exactly how literal or not quite literal he's being when he says the universe has a mind, you know? Mm-hmm. And what I was trying to say is that I love Hinton's, it's really startling, it's in the book Hunger Mountain, and he wonders whether our experience, you know, so here's a background thing quickly. Emerson says, and there are other thinkers who say this, that all our words for abstractions, like if we have a sense of what right or wrong is or something like that, that they're derived from words that were originally for physical objects, that the names for physical objects came first. And so he says, for example, that the word right used to mean straight, like a straight road, and the word wrong used to mean twisted, like a twisty road. So you could say in the old days, you know, if you want to get to my house, you better take the wrong road, because if you take the right road, you'll get lost. And that meant take the twisty road and not. And so our whole sense of any kind of inner reality, it becomes nameable and thinkable because we make some kind of metaphor, right? Like somehow when I perform the right action, it's like that straight road. And when that guy lies to me, it's like that twisty road. So really what Hinton is suggesting is that our entire conception of this interior mental space, and he's being speculative and poetic, but I think he really means it. He wonders whether our sense of our entire sense of what our minds are like or what consciousness is like isn't in fact modeled on a sense of sky. And so then if you say, well, is big mind just sort of a metaphor, though, when you say, well, but if mind's a metaphor that's based on sky, you almost sort of don't know which way the metaphor goes, do you know? So, I mean, I'm still not convinced that he means exactly like the universe thinks like human minds do, you know? But that there's something about the way things drift across the sky or rise and fall out there in the world that, you know, if it feels like our mental life, maybe you can say it's just a projection of our mental life, but you could also say maybe our mental life feels that way, you know, because you model our mental life on some things about that.
It just seems weird that Suzuki, you know, who follows Dogen, would say the universe and then the universe is mine.
Yeah. So that's why, I mean, one of the things that Norman insists on is that Dogen, and I don't know Dogen very well, but from top to bottom, he understands human mind as linguistic. You know, and so you're never, yeah. So it's somewhat odd to think of a universe that isn't linguistic as being like a mind. Yeah.
This might be kind of silly, but I hang out with my dog a lot, and I'm also paying a lot of attention lately to my assumptions, which fit in there somewhere too, with judgments and so forth, and reevaluate, really looking at assumptions that I took for the truth for so long, and it's like, oh, wait a minute. And then with being with the dog, he's like a mirror almost, or not a mirror, but what do you call it? Something to play off against, to be with and observe and stuff. And it's like, so here's the dog, and he doesn't have a thinking mind like we do.
Yeah.
And yet he gets by quite well in his world and is able to communicate his needs and emotions and so forth quite well. So I learn a whole bunch from him, and I don't quite know where I'm going with this, but maybe you could pick up on it.
I think it's a mystery. So I think dogs are sort of tricky because they spend so much time with people, you know. So I'll tell a story about a dog lying in a second, you know. It's pretty clear that mostly they. I mean. Like cats, I don't think they exactly have opinions, you know, in that sense. Though they may have preferences, but opinions seem somewhat more abstract, you know. But I mean, I think it's. I mean, one of the things you wonder about is if you didn't have language, would you experience everything as sort of interpermeated all the time? And that seems a little bit wrong, you know. So I mean, the other thing to say is that the whole kind of linguistic thing, the way language shapes our perceptions, is a sort of late development on stuff that Kant was already doing in the 18th century, where he was interested not so much in the language, but just in the perceptual structure. So for Kant already, just by virtue of your particular perceptual apparatus, whether you're in language or not, in some sense everything is projection only. Do you know what I mean? That you're filtering the thing through your sensorium. And I don't know what Buddhism for dogs would look like. Exactly. Do you know? I mean, that is how you would get them to practice to see more interpermeation. But so just quick digression, which has not much to do with anything, but there's a moment in Wittgenstein where he's talking about sort of language and how it shapes us and all that. And he says, with apparently great irony, he says, "Can a dog lie?" And then he says, "Why not? Is he too honest?" Which is really funny, you know. But we used to have a wolf hybrid, and they're quite smart. And you're not supposed to get up in the middle of the night to let your dog out. But once a night, if the dog scratched at the door, you know, we would let the dog out, and it didn't snowball. The dog wouldn't start scratching 8 times. So one night we were in bed, and the dog was there. Choya was her name, and she went to the back door and scratched to be let out. You know, right? And I got there to open the door for her, and she wasn't there. So I went back to bed, and she had taken my place on the pillow. So she was lying. You know. It was a joke, and I'm gonna lie.
It's quite instructive living with a dog, I think.
It's beautiful,
being.
Yeah.
Kind of being.
Anyway, I mean, I guess one of the reasons for the talk is my sense that, at least for me, sort of, you know, judgments and opinions and all that usually seem exactly like the things that get in the way. Like if I could sort of get rid of them, everything would be better. And in fact, I think to sort of see them as just, you know, rising and falling, and the more they become like that, the more there are no more impediments to an experience of the vastness than other things rising and falling in the field might be. And I also think, since they're so intimate and since we're so kind of fixated on them, it's something that we hold really tightly. And I mean, it's different for different people. Like John and Joan used to say, it took a lot longer for intellectuals to get enlightened because they were more committed to their opinions, you know. But it's so hard not to think, if I think it through better, then I'll get enlightened, you know, or if I had the right views rather than the wrong views, or if I could just get rid of all the views for once and just be like the dog, then I'd be fine. Whereas what I'm suggesting is that the, you know, just loosening the hold even of some particular judgment or opinion is likely to turn into a really intimate experience of the emptiness, you know. And, you know, the sense that the world isn't exactly like what you thought it was, can be really, I mean, everybody knows this, I guess, but can be really liberating. And I'm always struck by the really weird disproportion between just even small things kind of falling away and feeling like everything is sort of opened up, you know. So that's lucky, you know. I mean, just have some moments like that, and it's kind of a big deal. Yeah.
So when you talk like this, what could enlightenment be?
Yeah, I think the Suzuki, it's a couple of things. I think the Suzuki is really useful on the one hand, because he talks about, you know, a kind of Kensho experience as not exactly being an experience, right? So you don't sort of hold on to it like that. But I mean, I'll try and talk a little bit more tomorrow night in terms of, it won't be a lot more practical because I'm going to talk about William James, but, you know, and sort of walking around the world with your opinions and judgments. And Norman is quite good on this when he's in his talks on the Lanka. And one of his suggestions, which I was kind of joking about it, but I think it's really freeing, you know, is that in a way, I mean, Norman says, well, you know, somebody asks, well, what, you know, what is it? And he says the tradition really equivocates on whether there's something else to see, like you really see something else, or whether awakening really is just seeing your projections as projections. So there's a way in which, and again, I think this is really important, you're not going to get rid of your projections. We use them all the time. They're really useful. You know, we triage things all the time. But the sense is that if you simultaneously have some awareness of the kind of distorting, but even sort of illusory and empty quality of the models you walk around with, then there's a certain kind of lightness to it. And I'll try and talk about it tomorrow, but in practical sense, I think it's pretty useful not to be so dogmatic about our views, right? And, it, you know, so the first retreat I ever went to with Joan, somebody, I can't remember who it was, somebody from CDS asked her, you know, what's your definition of enlightenment? And she said, attentiveness and compassion. And the person said, that's it? You know, and she just said, that's it. But I think, I mean, I think to the extent that your views soften, you're more likely to treat people that way. And I think also, again, Norman is very funny, but he jokes and says, well, you know, it's great because it really isn't your responsibility to get it right. Do you know, in some way, you're going to walk around knowing you're always getting it wrong, knowing that the way you're modeling it is not quite the way it is. I'll talk some more about this the final night in relation to some stuff from Uchiyama. But my sense is that, you know, he says you're sort of likely to take your views less seriously, you're likely to sort of hold your place in things a little more lightly, and you're more likely maybe to sort of give up trying to convince everybody, including yourself, and just try to be helpful. You know, and again, you know, if you have a sense that the way you're treating somebody is maybe partly right, but partly, I don't mean evil, but like you don't know them really, your view of them is just your view, there's likely to be sort of a greater softness in the way you're willing to interact with them. So in that sense, you know, and so again, to go back to one of the places I started, if it really is true that really solidified sense of self we have is really intimately related, not even just to our being super judgmental, but just to always be the creature who makes judgments, then I think it really is true that if your sense of the validity of those judgments, you know, softens a little bit and you hold them more softly, that probably has something to do with, you know, little by little sort of generating a self that feels more permeable and less like the one who's always got to be in control of stuff. So my sense would be, and I'm no expert at this by any means, you know, it's sort of a down the road for me for sure, but, you know, to the extent that my views and opinions soften, you know, I think I'm a better person and a better teacher, and, you know, that sounds like enlightenment to me.
There's another talk by Norman called Beyond Language, where he talks about similar things, about how we're so steeped in language that, you know, maybe part of the things that we suffer with, the things that happen in our lives, the events of our lives, it's not, those aren't actually the problem, it's our descriptions of them.
Yeah. In the Lanka talks, he talks about that too. It talks about how often, you know, we go about 89 steps down the road in terms of some hypothetical problem that turned out, you know, it wasn't like you've already, it's like being a chess master, like you've already moved, like anticipated 50 moves ahead for how you're not going to get screwed. And it was all hypothetical, you know. So there's that. But again, I think one of the things that, and I was trying to give some sense of this in this talk, I mean, judgments and opinions are incredibly useful, right? And I'll try and talk some more about that tomorrow night. But useful or not, we're not, like Bill was saying, we're not going to get out of them, right? You're not going to get out of sort of moving around the world and categorizing it in various ways. And so there's a way in which, if you know that that's always in some way wrong, that a sense of humor, you know, about yourself and, you know, how you're marching around, ordering things around, is really valuable. And that feels very close to kind of the import of Zen to me over all these years, maybe especially studying with Joan, you know. And Norman kind of says, so, you know, don't take yourself so seriously. Like, you're always going to be wrong.
Yeah. I have a story that relates to what we're talking about. For quite a while, I had an agent for my paintings in Shanghai. And I called her younger sister, Chu Mei Mei. She's a very lovely person. And she really embodies the mind that's a product of the Chinese Revolution education. Mm-hmm. Like, she would analyze things, and then she would make a determination. And that determination sticks. That's how reality is. And I'm this kind of doubting, you know, kind of liberal guy who looks at things this way and that way. And her way is very useful. You know, she's a very effective businesswoman. Yeah. But yeah, she doesn't get, you know, it's like what occurs to me with the not knowing is the most intimate is not knowing who I am is the most intimate. Yeah. And I don't think she has any sense of that.
Yeah. That's great. So I think one of the implications of Isshito is that it ought to be possible. And I think Joan says this, you know, so how do you live in the world of multiplicity and the nirmanakaya, let's say, that way of viewing things, if you come back to it with a dharmakaya perspective, you know? And so the perfect, I don't know if it's perfect, a pretty good thing would be to be able to make those judgments, you know, this, that, and in some way, not to take them entirely seriously. And that's where, so I don't want to get into the talk for tomorrow night, but apparently when D.T. Suzuki came here and started lecturing at Columbia, he predicted that Zen would have a really happy future in the U.S. because it had a lot of affinities with the American pragmatist philosophy. And so James is really interested in practical value. So he's like your friend, you know, it's like, how are we gonna come up with the best model, you know, to do what we want to do. But he's got a sense at every moment that's like the Lanka, that when we do that, we're always modeling something in a way that distorts it. And I mean, Joan relied a lot on James and was quite explicit about doing that. But so when Joan talks about, you know, it's the model's provisional and it's our best guess at the moment, that's exactly in the lineage of American pragmatism, which in a way, you know the thing in the Koans, they're always saying, you know, but you have to be able to put it to use on the road. You know, what good is it, right? So I think in a way, James is like the Lanka on the road. Do you know what I mean? So how do you have a sort of pragmatist sense of your modeling and judgments and all that, so that you simultaneously can move around in a way that's good for you and other people, getting some stuff done, you know, without falling into this really rigidified sense either of, you know, your role in the world or your models of things. So everybody can skip tomorrow night. That's about tomorrow night. Well, we pretty much ran out the clock, I think, right? It's 8:40, so anything else this John used to say that must be said? All right, thank you very much.